we see it more and more that we see marketplaces perhaps don't want to have a take rate on the transaction, or just creating this volume and the monetization is or via the finance or via advertisements. So there's a real movement going on that the marketplace shouldn't necessarily be a transactional one from the first phase.
Welcome to Two Sided, the marketplace podcast, brought to you by ShareTribe.
Hello and welcome. I am Sjoerd, CMO at ShareTribe, and I am your host. In this episode, we dive into the world of B2B marketplaces with not one, but two guests. I'm joined today by Laurens Groenendijk and Bas Rieter from DFF. DFF uses stand for Dutch Founders Fund, and surprise, surprise, today's guests are also two of my fellow Dutchmen. Laurens and Bas both have a lot of experience also as founders, especially Laurens. He is the co-founder of Just Eat, one of Europe's biggest food delivery marketplaces, and Treatwell, one of Europe's biggest platforms for beauty and hair. As a fund, DFF has a strong emphasis on B2B, and that's why we talk a lot about that. Among other things, we discuss the rise of re-commerce and the role that technology plays there in creating trust and transparency within B2B marketplaces. We also discuss a familiar topic for those who have listened to other episodes as well, namely why focusing on niche markets can be the key to achieving fast growth in B2B spaces, especially for those many parts in industries that are still mostly non-digital. Also, another really nice highlight is about a shift in monetization strategies. So how certain B2B marketplaces are moving beyond traditional transaction fees to more hybrid models and exploring advertising and SaaS models. As you'll hear, this hangs together strongly with the need in certain industries for vertical SaaS, and even vertical SaaS sometimes being the stepping stone towards building a marketplace. So please listen to this episode to hear how the people at DFF are looking at the world of marketplaces, what they see coming, and especially on how aspiring founders can capture market share in under-digitized industries. Please enjoy my conversation with Laurens Groenendijk and Bas Rieter from DFF. Hi, Laurens. Hi, Bas. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time to be in here. Really great that you could both make it. I've heard a lot about DFF. I think you guys have been around for a couple of years. But before we go into all things DFF and what DFF means in the marketplace world, could you quickly introduce yourself? Maybe we can start with Laurens.
Yes. Hi, Sjoerd. I'm Laurens, one of the founders of the Dutch Founders Fund. I actually never worked for a Bas, so back in the days, almost 25 years ago, I started my career as an entrepreneur and basically started a company called Hapgids. Hapgids was a portal to order food online in the Netherlands, Germany, and in the UK. And eventually, we merged the company together with Just Eat in 2004, which we went to the UK and eventually went IPO in 2014. I was not operationally involved up till 2012. And then my wife said, there is no Just Eat for hairdressers. I said, hey, that's a nice idea. So together with a bunch of friends, I started Treatwell, of course, big marketplace for beauty and hair services, doing $2.5 billion GMV right now. We saw the company already after 18 months going live to a Japanese firm. And then I started my marketplace experience to do that in another vertical, which was fashion, and I built Minto, big fashion retail marketplace, sold that one to the bestseller group. And so basically that was, let's say, my career as a marketplace entrepreneur. And then I wanted to do something out of my comfort zone and build a space company called Hyber. But to be quite frankly, it was a little bit too much out of my comfort zone to build a global telecommunication network in space with new technology. And that was also the start when I, together with my partners here at DFF, Patrick Kersmakers from Vonk and Bas Behrens, founder of WeTransfer, we sit down together. Okay, let's go from the operational side to the investor side.
Okay, thanks. That is a lot of very relevant marketplace experience. Great. How about you, Bas?
My name is Bas. I'm one of the investors at DFF. We're using the names Dutch Founders Fund and DFF interchangeably because since a week or so, we've officially rebranded into DFF Ventures. Sometimes there was some misconception whether we would only invest in the Netherlands or, so this name captures a bit of our international footprint better. Prior to DFF, I have been at both sides of the table as a founder running my own company, selling trees and plants for indoors, as well as an investor by running and setting up the very first student-led venture capital fund of the Netherlands. And I also had a brief stint at LeapFunder, which is like an angel investing platform. So for my modest 20 years old that I've been walking around here, I've always been in and around startups, working and investing in marketplaces and vertical SaaS for the past 4 years here at DFF.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, thank you both for the intro. I think that's always, because it's, yesterday, for example, I mean, I'm going to date this episode, but earlier I talked to Jose Maren from FJ Labs, and he was also, him and Fabrice have also started, somewhere between three and five, like marketplace type companies. And you can see that it really helps as opposed to maybe other more general funds to understand that this is a slightly different beast.
Yes.
And maybe this is a good lead way into the question. Like, could you tell a little bit about DFF? Are there any particular verticals or models? Of course, marketplace model, but anything else that you're focusing on?
Yes, definitely. Of course, my background is more on a B2C, but within DFF, we focus more on the B2B marketplace. And particularly what we like is B2B marketplaces that will solve, let's say, real world industries problems. We like these legacy industries, helping them going online, most of the time doing that via marketplace.
Yeah. I think your tagline is investing in under-digitized assets.
Yeah, correct.
Not maybe one great for word of mouth, but
So that's what we're all
like. And I think one maybe good example company, maybe you could tell that, or at least the one that I liked, is Von Wood. Would that be a good example of one of that thesis?
Yes, definitely. And that's basically, that company was built, let's say, when we look in the market, different industries where there's kind of a homogene product in that sense. This is timber wood. Of course, there's a lot of different sizes and quality, but where the supply side is extremely fragmented. So a lot of, let's say, sawmills in the Nordics, Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
And of course, the problem on the buy side, where you can really help the demand getting the better prices where you skip the middleman.
Yeah. What I think is an interesting question always, because am I correct? Do I profile you correct that you're mostly pre-seed, seed stage fund?
Yes. And sometimes we also like the concept phase. So for concept, pre-seed, seed.
Okay. Yeah, but that's even better for my question, because it's easy to imagine, if you're a Series A investor, like you find something that works, so, have clear data, it looks like it's going up. But in your case, like if you, especially like maybe concept stage even, like, do you have a process by which you assess a deal or like a company coming in? Like more thinking from the point of, the founders who listen to this, like what are pointers that they should think about when they think about their business idea?
Yeah, so especially when we talk about B2B, is what we look at is, of course, is how big is the market, what type of product is it? Huh? So is it let's shoot fix where you have a marketplace, but the goods are so heavy that you can only for a good price transport it only 50 miles from a kind of supplier? Or can you really build a global marketplace from day one? We prefer, let's say, the global marketplace instead of, or at least a European or a nationwide marketplace, because that's going a little bit faster. Instead of, let's say, building these hyper-local marketplaces, that will take a while. Of course, first of all, we look at the margins in the chain. Then we really want to see how the traders or brokers in the market operate. Huh? Because, or the wholesale. So most of the time in this B2B trades, there is still this middleman. So how many steps between the buyer and eventually the seller are there? How much of these steps can we disrupt? Basically, what we also learned within DFF, how fast can we get this to market. Is it really the question that you really want to build a full-fledged website, marketplace platform from day one? Or can we already start trading tomorrow? And from there on, with these learnings, build something. So most of the time, the marketplace founders we see come from the industry. So they have this background in the industry. So they have already this Rolodex in place in order to fulfill a trade. And that is more the concept phase that we invest. Are they able to do this transaction without any digitalization? And from there on, we can, of course, build a full-fledged marketplace with all the tools on top of it to make it even more attractive.
If I can just add on that, like the good thing about a marketplace, especially in the beginning, is that quite often the very first, you know, value that you provide is bringing together supply and demand, right? And you don't really need like a flashy website or a platform to do that. Most often when founders come knocking on our door, they've already done some trades or matchmaking manually, albeit via like an Excel sheet, an Airtable, or, you know, in Homecooks, for instance, one of our portfolio companies, Josh actually started, and Homecooks morphed from a Facebook group where quite literally people who were selling, I don't know, their genuine jerk chicken towards their neighbor in a Facebook group that he started. Yeah. So he really seized that opportunity. And together with us, he actually built a Facebook group in a full-fledged marketplace where he could also leverage, you know, cross-border network effect, so to speak, that someone who made a jerk chicken in London could now actually sell their jerk chicken in Glasgow and not necessarily be restrained in a specific geographical area.
Yeah, that's super interesting because I think those are my favorite. So in previous seasons of Two-Sided, I've interviewed founders, and I think almost all of them have a story like this, right? Because we, you know, I won't advertise ShareDrop all the time, but basically we make like a marketplace backend as a service. So you can really easily build a full-fledged marketplace website with us. But then there is still, often we hear customers say, hey, I need, you know, feature X, Y, or C, otherwise it wouldn't work, or I need this thing. And I love hearing stories like from you as well, and from founders as well, that like, that often it's just a website and on the backend there's someone with five spreadsheets and just like, you know, having maybe some search, whatever, virtual lookup formula to match things. I'm really happy to hear also from your side that that's often like a good checkup, because I think that that is indeed.
That's
like
a behind the scenes solution where you can offer.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think like people sometimes forget that the, you know, I believe the marketplace, like it's not the platform is not the product. Like the product, like you said, is the liquidity, is bringing the both sides together.
Exactly.
Do you maybe have another like recent investment that you can talk about that you're excited about?
We are looking at a company right now that's basically when most of our marketplace are really transactional. This is basically because it's in the healthcare space. It's really the matchmaking. This interesting model where we skip the transaction because that's just too complex in this healthcare industry. But in order to do so, to really go for more a advertising model. So, and that's, we see more and more that we see marketplaces perhaps don't want to have a take rate on the transaction, or just creating this volume and the monetization is or via the finance or via advertisement. So there's a real movement going on that a marketplace shouldn't necessarily be a transactional one from the first phase.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, can we go down that road a little bit? Because I think that's an interesting observation, because that is also something that I've been wondering about, right? Because I think sort of traditionally people look at the history of marketplaces like, you know, classified, like no transaction involvement, then basic transaction involvement, then multi-layer involvement. And if I'm interpreting you right, and please correct me if I don't want to misquote you, but you're saying that you see a sort of movement of actually marketplaces, at least in your segment, like moving a little bit out of the transaction.
Yeah, sometimes.
And finding
definitely.
Yeah.
And it's more to create volume in a certain market. And when you hit the transaction or in the trade itself is not so much margin left, or it's too commoditized, so there's no margin. And there you see some quite interesting models popping up. Where they just to say, okay, let's create this liquidity and we take it from there. And most of the time we can monetize on the advertisement. And I think we have this great example bus in the US with this Vetted.
Yeah, could you tell a little about that?
VetGolf, you mean the veterinarian one, yeah. There, like, what you see is once you've really captured critical mass, and I think VetGolf sits on like an 80% market share, they are like a procurement platform for veterinarians. They monetize, like the lion's share of their monetization comes from ads, if I'm not mistaken. So they don't eat.
So ads how? Could you explain? So is there like some sort of featured listings? Should I think about that?
No, it's more external. More external from pharma selling or try to sell this type of vitamins for the dog or other medical equipment that can be applied to their target audience.
So they offer some sort of promotional services?
Yeah, definitely.
That is interesting. That's interesting. I haven't heard about that.
Because maybe what is also like good to talk about is that at DFF, you know, the business model that we know and, you know, like to work with the most is marketplaces. But we always say that niche SaaS solutions or vertical SaaS, as many VCs dub it, is the brother of many marketplaces, right? Especially in the beginning, you need to solve a problem for both sides, both the demand and both for the supply. So the marketplace business model is quite hard to get going. So we also noticed that many founders actually start off by aggregating or capturing either the supply side or the demand side with the SaaS proposition. And then once you've built up enough critical mass, then it becomes much more interesting to layer a transactional component on top. I mean, like a good example is Connect, which we backed a couple of years ago, and now they recently closed a round with HV Capital, I think 10 million. They really started off as a vertical SaaS for lenders. So they included, you know, CRM payments, KYC, you know, investor reporting modules to really capture, you know, the lender side. But then, as one can imagine, if you have a SaaS tool that, you know, neatly has captured, you know, all of the lenders in Europe and abroad, then it becomes more interesting for borrowers to also plug into the platform, right? So then you can also not only, you know, monetize on these features that I just, you know, explained, but also, you know, capture and monetize on the actual transaction. So, you know, that's also what we do, you know, vertical SaaS or vertical AI now, and marketplaces are really our two biggest areas of
it. Yeah, and what Bas is saying, for example, at Tweetwell, back in the days, we were, let's say, focusing on this marketplace, getting this demand up running, and we found out that we can bring all these orders to the hairdresser, but they actually can't fulfill it because we did it at the allocation on the time slots. So basically, we had to pivot to build kind of a scheduling tool for. So it's it's also very necessary to get kind of a SaaS proposition first in the supply in order to make the demand marketplace work for them.
By now, a quite common approach like this, I come for the tool, stay for the network, normally usually, yeah.
And perhaps what is really nice, what we see right now, especially we see a lot of inbound from this re-commerce marketplaces out there. And what we see is in order to get trust, so marketplace is a lot of about creating trust, it should be transparent and should be traceable. Right now, with all these, let's say, re-commerce products out there, with also in the B2B, so we see we are invested in a company called Metaiko, scrap metal marketplace. We see it in, let's say, secondhand iPhone business to B2B trades. And what we see is common that you see a little more hardware is implemented into the trades.
Okay.
That's more from an inspection and grading perspective. So in order to get to a kind of a trade, you should, let's say, inspect it or grade it in order to get to the right price. So the buyer actually have trust in that he buys it at the right price.
Yeah.
And the right quality.
Yeah, that is an interesting layer, actually. Like I've talked, maybe last year, I talked to a really interesting marketplace called, I hope I say this right, Shortboxed, their marketplace for comics, and where also, like, you know, like for any kind of these collectibles that you need some neutral judge of, like, what is the quality, right? Like it's not like you said, like you can't just trust the other person buying it. So I believe they also provided a service like that where they would be like there's sort of like I think they first started with like an existing sort of grading service that people were familiar with. But I think over time, if I'm not mistaken, they started building their own service so that you have indeed like a unified measure, like, okay, this is quality. You can trust this because this is, you know, we're objective in this.
But I see also from that perspective, I see a nice opportunity to create a marketplace of, let's say, creator economy doing grading for different type of verticals. Huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there's also the nice thing, like once you see a marketplace somewhere, you start seeing.
Yeah, definitely.
So but you said layering, right? That's also the exercise that we quite often do together with the founders, right? Because there are different, the question is always, what margin pool are you chasing and how can you expand your margin pool, right? So it's really like an exercise, okay, you know, at the very first and at the very beginning, you can take, let's say, 1 to 2% take rates by simply bringing together supply and demand. And then, there are different features we talked about, adding financial services, SaaS that often, includes compliance or KYC modules. But just what Lauren said, I think adding grading or inspection facilities, so really hardware, is something that we've not seen around that often, actually. So whether it is for Metaiko that actually allows the buy side to get a much better insight in the quality of, let's say, the aluminum, or whether it is for Northletter or Getmobile, two of our other portfolio companies that have built their own inspection infrastructure that allows them to very granularly show the quality of a used mobile cell phone. You can only imagine what that does to not just the perceived value, but the actual underlying value of the goods that you're transacting, right?
Yeah, especially in it, like when you think about this whole section of like what Lauren said, like re-commerce, whether that is actually, I've only thought of that term previously, sort of in terms of fashion and those kind of things, but indeed, like also industrial or like semi-industrial things. Because indeed, like I think a lot of the, like I think in the price that you usually pay for secondhand, you sort of underpay because you know there is a risk. Like you know that once in every 20 buys you're going to buy.
Exactly.
Something that's not great. And so that you basically calculate in your price. Well, if you can take that away, suddenly you can take a lot more out of that transaction. I never thought about that. This is great. I love doing this podcast. Okay. So we've already sort of uncovered two like interesting models, what Lana said, that actually marketplace is moving away from the transaction or looking at different ways of monetizing. And now like this grading model. Have you seen other trends, like maybe even on, for example, customer acquisition side or other things? You mentioned already a little bit like AI. So we've discussed that you start looking at SaaS, right? Like as a sort of complementary or potentially morphing into a marketplace. What have you seen AI unlock in this like supply demand game? Like how does AI influence your investment strategy? And maybe if there's a possibility to link that to marketplaces.
So we have one company that Famstar that's already back in the day started with, is let's say, getting AI in place to aggregate demand. And that was, let's say, 4 or 5 years ago. It was quite new. And now we see, of course, AI moving also into the marketplace. For us as a B2B marketplace, and that is from a front perspective, we call it internally, we have our hedge because we are providing and supporting this real economy trades. Yeah? So we're not so exposed. But of course, we see a lot on, let's say, getting the listings faster, better, and better conversion on a marketplace, especially in the B2B part, sales support. Because when the Rolodex is coming to an end, of course you have to go out. But we also see that there's a big risk. And we make a little bit strange advice to our portfolio companies, because I think in a couple of years from now, there will become a tsunami of all these applications, support tools, sales support tools, that actually, I think we'll get into a moment that when you really want to build a proper B2B marketplace, you have to get the physical sales in place. Huh? So I think that is getting out of your comfort zone behind your screen and go to the streets. I think that will be more and more when you can do it. Like simple, more SME focused, then you can do it, of course, with enterprise. It will be a bit tougher. But so it's more sales support, more the hygiene factors.
Yeah.
It's not right now we don't see it in the real trade yet, other than, let's say, the AI hardware technology, inspection technology.
Yeah.
But we don't see it, let's say, hardcore in the trades.
Because it's funny what Lauren said, right? We really like, you know, solutions for non-digital industries. And that poses a lot of opportunities, but also challenges. Generally speaking, VCs have a tendency to like and prefer tools that are built for, like, you know, a digital first audience that you can reach via email, cold calling, you name it. Sometimes, and most often, you know, whether it's vertical SaaS or a marketplace that operates in, like, a very under digitized domain, that also poses challenges for your initial outreach, right? For instance, we did, it's still in stealth, but we did, we made an investment in a vertical SaaS for the maintenance industry. And as you can imagine, like, these guys are quite often busy and, you know, not sitting behind their computer, right? So that also necessitates a different approach. You cannot just simply knock on their virtual door. No, you actually have to get out there, you know, and do field sales, which nowadays seems, you know, almost like a dirty word to some degree. Because people have been, you know, are used to building these automated drip campaigns, retargeting campaigns and whatnot. But really, you know, founders are sometimes underestimating the impact and the effect that going out there in the field can actually have, you know, what type of,
Yeah, and of course, actually what you mentioned is also a good point that, like, of course, for AI to be effective in any kind of field, you need stuff to be digital, first of all, right? Like, the, you know, like ChatGPT is not going to go door to door to figure this out. Yeah. So, like, it is kind of a blocker. And I guess at the same time, that's also maybe an additional reason for that opportunity, because you, if you are the first one to digitize that, you have this mode, right? Like, this is not publicly available information for any sort of LLM to scrap then.
Ah, it's definitely not easy, right? Because otherwise everyone would do it. And especially, like, the complexities in the sales, but quite often also, who are you disrupting, right? I mean, we are not investing in any other DevOps tools because the status quo is already quite efficient. In more under-digitized industries, however, like, the status quo is, like, a very clunky and outdated ERP system, or in the worst cases, like, pen and paper-based workflows, right? So just the efficiency gains by digitizing that first is already quite substantial. But then again, massive, the complexity remains, okay, how do you really move the needle and really change, you know, or induce a behavioral change? Because quite often these people are like, okay, if it works, it works. Why should I bother, you know, optimizing this in the first place?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I talked in, I think the first is to, but it's still one of my favorite examples, this marketplace called Craxi. They do a marketplace for commercial real estate, and where it was somewhere in the middle, it was like partly digital, but it mostly involved still like emailing spreadsheets and stuff like that, and emailing the same spreadsheet every Friday because everybody was waiting for this report. Yeah. And I think what they did was like somehow making the next step, but indeed, I think they sort of chose not to induce this behavior, but just make their product strong enough that it was almost a no-brainer to change the behavior because you just save 4 hours with one button.
Yeah.
All right. This is really, really insightful. You're looking at many deals every week. You meet with teams in conceptual, pre-seed state, product state, like you said already, like, you talk to them about maybe thinking about how to do this without a website. Are there any either coming winners or like common mistakes that you see when you meet early stage teams that our audience can learn something from? Just what they should be wary of, or what should they definitely do or not do?
Yeah. Also, to make life easier, not that we like, of course, this more vertical approach instead of a horizontal approach, but I think it makes so much more sense to build a company where you're in this niche, but really big niche, and and adapt your go-to-market strategy on that. So also we see here internally a lot of, let's say, AI tools. Okay, we can fix everything, but when you, let's say, ask them the question, but can you only sell it to all the butchers here in the Netherlands and start there? And that sometimes creates kind of a different mindset to get this focus on. What they most of the time really underestimated is this under-digitized verticals. So in this industry, a lot of, let's say, people that are by themselves are a little bit under-digitized. So in order to move the underlying market into kind of a digitized position will take time. We see that also with Vonwood, for example, in the timber trades. It's very old fashioned.
Yeah.
And why would they, let's say, move already now?
to a platform when they have this guy already for 30 years in their phone. So
yeah,
that really doesn't make a big difference for them. So then you have to go to market with a different angle in the market, and perhaps a full-fledged buyer-seller is a little bit too fast, but perhaps first try to digitize the traders that are already in that trade, that already have the buyer and the seller. You don't have to acquire the buyer and the seller that's already there, but first of all, start with, let's say, the traders or the brokers in the market to digitize them, and then in order to, let's say, to make the next step, go to all, end-to-end. Of course, you can be aspirational and ambitious, but you also have to be realistic and really have to know the underlying market, what the dynamics are.
Quite often, or especially in B2B, right? Trust is often the catalyst for liquidity. You know, we're talking about large order values, about trade lines that have been around for, you know, decades and decades. So there might be a hesitance for both participants to actually, you know, transact online. So what would really help to also build that trust is what Laurent said, right? Is to, obviously, you know, like young and hungry sales guys, for instance, can definitely have material impact. But if you take someone from the industry who knows and who has lived through the problem, him or herself, who can onboard his or her own Rolodex and also talk with, you know, potential customers in a mirroring way, then you can really also feed back to that core tenet of any marketplace, which is trust, right?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Yeah, and I think that is indeed, like, I don't remember now, did Laurens or Bas say this, but finding the balance, because of course you want your as a founder, you should be sort of unrealistically optimistic. You should have in your head, like, some sort of total addressable market that is just, is very big. But at the same time, you should also, then your first step should be indeed like niche for niche for niche and just make it happen there and then maybe figure out, do you have a plan?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you see any other developments on any lane, like whether it's technological, legal, financial, for marketplace founders that they should be aware of in the cut?
On the positive side, I think marketplaces, there's the market's getting more and more regulated. It will be easier to, let's say, have a managed marketplace with a kind of a SaaS component in it. It will be easier to sell, because most of the times these parties in the trade don't have this technology on board. That for example, an ESG report or a tax report or whatever report you need with the push of the button comes out of the system. So, and there you're really going to compete with all these new type of SaaS companies that are going, that we see in this compliance market. But I think that's a really, it could be a very beneficial for marketplace founders. To use that angle, the regulation angle and compliance angle, to in order to get them on the platform.
Yeah, that's a surprise one actually, because I think usually like entrepreneurs are like, oh, like legislation, like paperwork, please know about. But yeah, that's a good point.
Also customs. So for international trades, where you have, let's say, AI tooling for doing the duty tech, that kind of, let's say, angles that, that I will call it internally, the kind of the sexy angles that really can make a difference. Yeah. Sounds small, but could be really, really big to enter certain markets.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially, I think those things, particularly, like, they are, at Cheddar, we always talk about, like sort of a positive friction and negative friction. Like, this is like, that report delivers zero value to your core business. So if, like, why, the little resource you can put to it, the better, kind of, like. So if you can take that away, that is fantastic.
Something which I really like, and I'm being closely more paying attention to, is the role of video commerce, especially in B2B, right? Because this has been a no-brainer, especially in Asia, when it comes to, you know, e-commerce on beauty, cosmetics, trading cards, you have, you know,
like social selling,
exactly
kind of
but
stuff.
Just the role of video, because everyone has been talking about AI, and don't get me wrong, we, no one is underestimating like the impact that it can have, but just video as such is not a medium that you see used often. And now I think it was last week that marketplaces in livestock or cattle, right? So really, you know, digitizing the auction of livestock and cattle, their video is obviously a no-brainer. Right. And it's just interesting. Yeah. You see interesting models emerging where the role of video, you know, is as impactful or maybe even more impactful as it has been in the consumer space.
Yeah, video. Yeah, I haven't actually, I think, like I mentioned, the social selling, this is one of these things that I feel sort of like a generational gap. Like, I'm 43. I don't see myself doing that. But on the other hand, like, this is maybe one of these like macro shifts that there's a whole, you know, generation coming into the workforce, also B2B, who this mm-hmm. is a great way mm-hmm. to judge a deal and to judge supply. Yeah.
It's funny that you say that, because we also see a more like macro cultural shift about this new generation of business owners, right? That also demand mm-hmm. Quote unquote consumerized experience. Like it's so weird past decades, you know, many B2B trades have been, you know, been made via, you know, spreadsheets, telephone, or even especially in Germany, with all due respect, over fax. Mm-hmm. But now that there's a new generation of business owners who are used to seamless experience, whether it's ordering a cab or booking an apartment abroad, like why can you not just uh-huh. apply the same, you know, UX UI on B2B transactions, right?
To add on that, I met a couple of people the last couple of months, and there's basically a second or third generation business owner. So we saw it in mm-hmm. the big trader in Italy, where basically the third generation is now making decision to disrupt their own business. Yeah? Their father was also in this meeting and said, do you agree? Because your live work is going to be destroyed because your son's going to build a marketplace on top. No. And he was fine. And the same, let's say, 1 month later, Bas and I spoke with the company in Germany, exactly the same, a 75 million euros turnover business. So this mm-hmm. new generation wants to disrupt it. Very risky, of course. But that is what we're seeing in this type of, let's say, legacy industries.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Well, this was great. If people want to reach out to DFF, what is the way to pitch your startup to DFF?
You can reach us on... Especially if you're building something in the re-commerce space or, you know, heavily or critically under-digitized B2B domains, we'd be very happy to have a chat with you.
All right. I want to thank you both very, very much for your time and your insights. I think this is a great episode. Let's
Thanks.
Be in touch.
Okay. Thanks, George. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Two-Sided, the Marketplace podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And if you really liked it, please give us a rating or a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. If you got inspired to build your own marketplace, go visit www.sharetribe.com. It's the fastest way to build a successful online marketplace business.